be seated. Good morning. We have Court with Class here today, Wisconsin Lutheran High School. If you could please stand so we can say hello to you. Nice to have you here today. And Justice Rebecca Bradley will be meeting with you today, so save up all sorts of good questions, not about the case, but other challenging things because she likes to be challenged. So nice to have you here. Go ahead and have a seat. The case that we're going to hear today is State versus HC. It's 23 AP 1950. Could I start with appearances? Good morning. All right, good morning.
Good morning, Elizabeth Miller, appearing on behalf of the state.
Good morning. All right, the lineup that I have is 20 minutes to start, followed by 25 minutes, and 5 minutes. All right, with that, let's get going.
Good morning again, and may it please the court. Again, my name is Chris Sobick, and I represent HC, the mother, in this termination of parental rights case. This case here today centers around the disposition hearing in a TPR matter. At disposition, a parent's rights are not yet terminated, and whether to terminate is one of the most wrenching and agonizing decisions in the law. Previously, appellate courts have said that whether or not to terminate a parent's rights at disposition is a discretionary decision for the circuit court to make. If the statutes controlling disposition in a termination of parental rights case do in fact make the termination decision at that hearing a discretionary one for the circuit court, then those statutes controlling disposition are unconstitutional, as due process requires the petitioner in a TPR matter to prove that termination is in the child's best interest by some level of proof.
Do you advance in those comments that exercise of discretion, ipso facto, thought I'd throw that in to make it sound pretty good.
Sure.
Automatically means that there's no burden of proof? You think that? That's incredible to me, so be careful how you answer.
I'll do my best to be careful, and I guess I would say I don't think that, but I recognize that that is something that courts have determined previously, that it is a discretionary decision. And if that is in fact the case, then I think it's unconstitutional because due process would require a burden of proof. However, I do think there is a way also to look at this statute and that this court could decide.
What precedential case do you cite for that premise?
Which one?
The premise that, the ipso facto premise, that an exercise of, if a case stands on an exercise of discretion, that that automatically means there's no burden of proof. What case do you cite for that premise?
Are you asking me what case do I cite for the in cases that are judged through a discretion by the court, is there a case that then says it can't also be governed by some sort of burden of proof? Is that the question you're asking, Justice Bradley?
Can I help?
Yes, I thought my,
I think
my ipso facto must have come in.
Yeah, ipso facto went out the door.
Yeah, that's right.
I take it back.
I think what Justice Bradley And what I heard you say was, if you have a scenario where the statute calls for judicial discretion, that means there is not a burden of proof, and that means the statute is unconstitutional. And I think what you're being asked is, what's your authority for that?
I guess my answer to that is I don't have any authority for that line. And that's why I believe, and sort of what I was going to get into, is that I think just looking at the statute in itself, that there is a burden of proof within the statute. Disposition in the statutes controlling that is a evidentiary fact-finding hearing. And because of that, it has to be governed by some sort of burden of proof.
Can you tell me how it's evidentiary? And then I'm going to ask you to tell me how it's fact-finding, because I see this as very different than what is going on in the jurisdictional hearing. So what is evidentiary about this?
Well, the statute the disposition statute does indicate that at disposition, any party may present evidence relevant to the best interest of the child. So I think it establishes the disposition hearing through that statute as an evidentiary type hearing. And then it becomes fact-finding because the court is required to consider a laundry list of factors and facts before coming to the ultimate conclusion about whether or not termination is in the best interest of the child. So I think it's the combination of those two things that make disposition an evidentiary fact-finding hearing.
The rules of evidence don't apply.
They don't. But I don't think that that is a requirement for it to be evidentiary in nature. I mean, the statute also contemplates parties calling witnesses and presenting testimony on disposition and the ultimate question that the court has to answer.
So, counsel, I think you just touched on something. You've got multiple people who can call witnesses at a dispositional hearing. I think the Court of Appeals referred to the burden as a common burden. How do you handle all of that, and who would actually have this burden if, in fact, there is one?
Well, I think the burden would – I don't know of any sort of legal basis or support or any place that I've ever seen a notion of a common burden. I mean, burdens are placed on one party or the other. And in a termination of parental rights case, I believe the burden would have to be placed on the petitioner or the state as it is in this matter.
Because well, what if the guardian ad litem calls a number of witnesses? The guardian ad litem actually makes the recommendation as to whether it's in the best interest of the child, right? So I'm having a hard time determining or actually putting that burden on the state, a really hard time with it.
And I guess I believe that the burden has to be on the state because they're the ones bringing the petition. They're the ones bringing the petition asking for the parents' rights to be terminated. They're the ones asking for this very serious deprivation of a constitutional right. And because of that, I believe it would be on the state to meet a burden of proof at the disposition hearing.
But counsel, at the grounds phase, the state already met the burden by clear and convincing evidence to establish that grounds exist for terminating the parent's rights, and the parent has, at that point, been deemed unfit. So I'm struggling to understand how that burden remains with the state when the court has the six statutory factors to consider and can consider evidence and arguments presented by multiple parties. I mean, I sat in termination of parental rights court in Milwaukee County, and I can tell you exactly how I did it. It's no big secret. I had a template that laid out the factors, and as I was listening to testimony and arguments, I would take notes in my template outline under each factor, and at that point, my decision kind of wrote itself as to whether the factors established that it would be in the best interest to terminate or to not terminate and then continue the CHIPS proceeding with the parent. So how, in your mind, would it work for the state? Would they have to establish that 4 out of the 6 factors support termination? Would they have to establish that, okay, maybe some of these factors weigh in favor of not terminating, but this factor is the most important and the evidence is overwhelming? Because I know you're concerned about the subjectivity that judges might introduce in that decision making, but the factors do provide the legislature's policy decision about how the courts are to make that. And it is, I mean, it's a tremendous thing. It changes, obviously, the parents' lives, the child's life, maybe, depending on the relationship that exists or not. But I'm struggling a little bit. It sounds like you're asking for something that's going to fundamentally change the approach that judges take when they're making this very fundamental and consequential decision. But the legislature's already laid it out for us. And frankly, I didn't have any trouble as a circuit court judge applying those factors. I'm not sure how the imposition of the burden of proof, as you're asking us to sort of create, how that exactly works. So does my question make sense? I know it's a bit long.
No, I think I understand what you're getting at. I guess maybe something I would say up front is the change I'm asking for, which is first that there's a clear and convincing burden of proof at disposition, or at the very least that there's a preponderance of the evidence. I don't think either one of those burdens would change the way in which termination of parental rights
can... All right, but you already said you don't agree that there's a common burden.
Can I get an answer? I don't think you finished answering my question.
I don't think that if there was a burden, it would fundamentally change how termination of parental rights cases proceed and how disposition hearings proceed. I believe, and Justice Bradley, you'd know this from your experience as well, is that disposition hearings always start with the state presenting evidence to support their request for termination. And so the hearings would continue the same way. The court also, in making its decision whether or not a different burden of proof applies, can consider all those factors that are listed within the statute. And the question the court's then asking is the greater weight of evidence or the clear and convincing evidence in support of disposition while considering those factors? And I don't think you can break it down into, is it 3 out of 6, is it 4 out of 6? It's looking at all of them, whether the greater weight of the evidence or the clear and convincing evidence convinces the court that termination's appropriate.
All right, so I want to go back to that common burden. You said you don't agree that there's a common burden as opined by the Court of Appeals. Does that mean that if the guardian ad litem is presenting witnesses, obviously they're not being presented by the state, they're being presented by the guardian ad litem, that the state is not to or that the court is then not to rely on those witnesses when determining whether or not the burden of proof has been met?
No, I mean, I don't think that the court has to just ignore the evidence that would be potentially introduced by the guardian ad litem. I think that's evidence that the court can consider without a doubt. But I guess ultimately, at the end of the day, the burden would be on the state to meet that burden, whatever it might be, and they couldn't rely on the guardian ad litem to make their case for them.
So, I'd have the same question for any of you, so I'll just say it once, and then hopefully people will address it. But part of my question is this language, best interests of the child, also is in other places in the statutes, like in family court proceedings, divorces, custody placement proceedings. What's the burden of proof there? with almost identical language. That's the first part of my analysis. And play devil's advocate. What if you're wrong? Okay, clearly the legislature didn't put the words in the statute like they have in other places where they want a... How does the legislature then change the statute to remove the court-imposed burden of proof when that language doesn't appear? I mean, it's not like the legislature can say we really, really mean no burden of proof. I don't know how that would be corrected given the actual language of the statute now versus when you compare it to other statutes where there is clearly a burden of proof stated.
Sure. I guess certainly the statute as it's written right now also doesn't clearly say that this is a discretionary decision for the court either. I mean, that's not written into the statute. And so that is something that has been determined through case law that this is a discretionary decision that the court makes at disposition. So it's not specifically listed there either. But I would say, too, that at the very least, as I was discussing before, the statute makes disposition a evidentiary fact-finding hearing. And at those types of hearings, there needs to be a burden of proof. TPRs are civil cases, and the ordinary burden of proof in civil cases is preponderance of the evidence at the very least. And so I believe to some extent the legislature would be aware of sort of this default that it, in fact-finding hearings in civil cases, that the fallback is preponderance of the evidence.
So then,
and they wouldn't have to write it into the statute.
Custody and placement determinations would also have a new burden of proof?
Well, I guess I can't speak to everyone because I know that some statutes certainly clearly list that clear and convincing controls. I also not sure that all of those statutes clearly establish the same type of evidentiary fact-finding hearing. And then one of the other biggest things is that some of those hearings that you're referring to, Chief Justice Ziegler, don't have the deprivation of a constitutional right. And that's what we have in this case. At disposition, the court is still making the decision and has not yet made the decision whether or not a parent's constitutional right to parent their child is going to be taken away. And so this puts it, a disposition and a termination of parental rights case, in a different category than some of those less permanent statutes and family law and CHIPS cases.
Counsel, I would just put aside your statutory argument for just a moment that this, doesn't say that there, but that is the normal civil burden, that argument, and just want to focus on your constitutional argument. The implication of your argument, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the legislature cannot permissibly impose either no particular burden and choose best interests of the child, and cannot impose a burden of preponderance of the evidence, that those would be unconstitutional under the federal constitution. Is that correct?
My argument is that due process requires some burden of proof at disposition. I believe that based on the seriousness of the right that could still be taken away from a parent, their deprivation of their constitutional right to parent their child, that in looking at the factors that Santosky discusses, that clear and convincing is required.
So if you're correct, I think the standards in many states would be unconstitutional. Is that fair?
I believe that that's possible. Other states could just come to the determination that a preponderance of the evidence is sort of already in their statute.
I'm not talking about the statutory argument. I'm talking just straight
sure.
constitutional argument. I think your argument, from misunderstanding, would be that all those states that have anything less than clear and convincing, those are all unconstitutional. If you're correct, on your main constitutional
correct.
Is that right?
That's correct.
Are you aware of any courts that have so held?
That clear and convincing applies in a termination of parental rights.
And that anything less is a violation of due process and unconstitutional.
I am not aware of other jurisdictions that have done that. I know that Illinois and Arizona have broached this topic and found that due process requires a preponderance of the evidence, but I'm not aware of a case where it went as far as clear and convincing evidence.
When you were talking about the other statutes, and I know that the chief asked you about family cases, and I know that there was an argument made about sentencing, isn't your best argument that those are situations where a judgment is made at that point, but there is a conclusory judgment of some kind, either of conviction or of divorce, and that that next phase is separate and apart, whereas here there's nothing conclusive other than it's a finding that the parent is unfit. It is a change in how we treat their parental rights, but termination may not happen. That child may still wind up with that parent. Is that really the key distinction between all of these other analogies?
I think you're absolutely right. So one of the biggest differences, I know there's been attempts to compare disposition in a TPR to sentencing, and although there might be some superficial similarities, the biggest difference is that once someone's convicted in a criminal case, the decision's been made already that their liberty or freedom is going to be constrained in some way, shape, or form. And sentencing is not about making that decision, whereas in a termination of parental rights case, it's still up in the air. The parents' rights haven't been terminated, and whether they're going to be and that constitutional right's going to be deprived still has to be decided. And so my time is up, but I think that's an argument for why discretionary doesn't work in TPR disposition.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Courtney Rolance, and I am the guardian ad litem in this case, representing the minor child's best interests. I have 2 points. First, we are asking that this court hold that either under the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause or statutory interpretation, the burden of proof at TPR disposition is governed by the ordinary burden of proof or preponderance of the evidence. Second, we are asking that this court hold that analysis on this new rule is reviewable under the harmless error doctrine, and specifically here that HC is not entitled to a new disposition hearing. When I conclude, I will ask that this court affirm the Court of Appeals, but clarify which party holds the burden of proof. Turning first to the constitutional analysis of this issue, without question, the 14th Amendment applies to the bigger picture or question is how it impacts disposition, if at all. HC focuses almost exclusively on the reasoning in Santosky to aver that under federal law it must be clear and convincing evidence. But Santosky stopped short of addressing disposition and used distinctions between grounds and disposition to make its conclusions. Those distinctions are critical to this analysis. I view 3 main points from Santosky that differentiates grounds and dispo.
That differentiates what? I didn't hear that last.
Sorry, time. Grounds and disposition.
Okay.
I'm sorry, in practice we call it dispo. First, Santosky really focused on the idea that grounds is pitting the state against the parent. The dispute at the grounds phase is really what the state did and what the parent did not do, which is a kind of inherent culpability sort of assessment. At disposition, the focus is on the child. There's no culpability assessment anymore. That kind of concern from Santosky is eliminated. The second big focus in Santosky was that the courts could not presume that the parent and child were adversaries at the grounds phase of the case. That's prior to an unfitness finding. The parent has not been found unfit. But at disposition, it is after the unfitness finding. And Santosky noted specifically that the court may assume that the parent and child's interests do diverge at disposition. Third was the ability to collect evidence. At the grounds stage, the state, I believe the language was, inevitably dwarfs the parent's ability to mount a defense, their ability to collect evidence. At disposition, an involved parent is in the best position to offer evidence on the subject of the child's best interest, both historically, thinking factor two, age and health of the child, and moving forward. What are the child's relationships? What is the likelihood of a permanence and stability? What other options are there in the family? Given those three big differences, I don't think the Santosky analysis can fit perfectly when trying to figure out what are we doing at disposition. The governing analysis for a constitutional issue like this is Matthews versus Eldridge and the three-part test therein. That looks at three main prongs. One, the private interest at stake. Two, the risk of error created by the state's chosen procedure. And three, the state's countervailing interest in the status quo. So first, looking at the private interests, a parent retains their constitutional rights. That was, I believe, noted by Justice Dallet. They're changed after an unfitness finding, but they exist still at the disposition phase. Now you have to compare that with the child. A child has an urgent interest in not being separated erroneously from their birth parent, but they also have an urgent risk in not being reunified erroneously with an abusive parent. The state's interest is really aligned with the child's. The state's interest is in a fair and an accurate decision that's balancing all of those rights. When you look at those three together, the parties at disposition are sharing roughly equal interests, and those interests are roughly equally balanced by a preponderance of the evidence.
I'm not sure I agree with that, because going back to my question to your friend on the sort of other side, but sort of on the same side, we have an unfitness finding. So that, as you've acknowledged, changes things for the parent. So at that point, the court has made a determination, or sometimes a jury has made a determination, that grounds exist, rights, the parent is unfit. I understand there's still an interest at stake for the parent, but we shift. The statute shifts. I don't think there's anything unconstitutional about making the rights of the child, the best interests of the child, paramount over the parent at that stage because the parent has been found unfit. So I'm questioning your characterization, and you said it in the brief as well, that they that you're kind of making their interests roughly equal at that point. And I didn't ask your friend, I'll just call him this question, but maybe in rebuttal, I will. It almost seems to me that there could be a burden on the parent to say, okay, I know you found me unfit. I know grounds exist to terminate my parental rights. Here's why you shouldn't terminate my parental rights. Because at this stage, the court really has everything the court needs to make the determination. The court could, but there's this added protection already statutorily. There has to be a disposition hearing. The parent is heard from again. There's a last kick at the cat, if you will. Okay, judge, here's things that have been going on. Here's why you really shouldn't terminate. Can you respond to that?
I think there are a few different considerations. The first is, to some degree, unfortunately, I'm not aware of any case that in writing gives a child constitutional rights. I think all of us like to kind of think that children have a constitutional right to be in a safe home. There's nothing like Santosky for kids. there is for parents, and so they're unfit, and that right is diminished. But the only person really in this hearing that has a written, recognized, U.S. Supreme Court says so, constitutional right is that unfit parent. And so I think that's sort of where I'm looking at. The person with a really written down, absolutely recognized constitutional right is the unfit parent who's still at a risk of an erroneous termination and has an interest against that.
Go ahead. I don't want to interrupt you, but I have a follow-up on the constitutional right. But
versus the child that doesn't have a super clear written down constitutional right that I think all of us want to recognize has a right to a decision that was thought through very carefully. Because again, I think they have a dual interest in not being sent home when they shouldn't be and not being permanently separated from their birth family when they shouldn't be. And that's where I see it becoming, like I said, roughly equal. I don't know that you can ignore a parent's still existing, though diminished, constitutional right to just completely flip the
analysis.
Are
you talking about due process?
Yes.
Right. And that's where, again, I'm struggling with the argument that would place an enhanced burden that the legislature hasn't placed, and you are invoking, both of you, the Constitution for that. But at this point, the parent has had a grounds phase hearing, a full evidentiary trial, if you will, has been found unfit by clear and convincing evidence. Grounds exist to terminate parental rights. And then, even though those findings have been made, that determination has been made, then there is another hearing. So I'm struggling to see where the due process argument would suggest that the parent isn't getting due process, because again, the parent has a voice at the disposition hearing and has just as much right to present evidence on those six factors that the judge has to take into account in making the termination decision.
I think part of the analysis here, it turns on, and there's been some discussion on it, it turns on whether or not the dispositional phase is viewed as an evidentiary hearing that requires a burden of proof. To questions, and I hope this answers your question in a moment, to kind of address Justice Karofsky's question earlier about the evidentiary hearing and Justice Dalek kind of talking about the comparison to sentencing. In Wisconsin statute 972.14 for criminal sentencing, the legislature says in that statute, and I quote, that the parties have an opportunity to make a statement with respect to any matter relevant to the sentence. But in Wisconsin statute 48.427, they say, and I quote, the parties may present evidence relevant to the issue of disposition. If TPR is viewed as an evidentiary hearing, the U.S. Supreme Court has talked about that the function of a standard of proof, the function of a burden of proof, I'll quote you for it in Addington versus Texas at 441 U.S. 418 from 1979, the function of a standard of proof, as that concept is embodied in the Due Process Clause and in the realm of fact-finding, is to instruct the fact-finder concerning the degree of confidence our society thinks he should have in the correctness of factual conclusions for a particular type of adjudication. The standard serves to allocate the risk of error between the litigants and to indicate the relative importance attached to the ultimate decision. That's at page 423 of Addington versus Texas. So kind of to get to the end of answering your question, the Due Process Clause applies if this is an evidentiary hearing that needs a burden of proof. I think that kind of plays into, too, there's these kind of roughly equal interests between the parent and the child in the disposition being decided consistently and in a way that society thinks that the court should have confidence in that conclusion at disposition. A discretionary decision or no burden, I think, is essentially telling people we don't need the court to have confidence in the best interest finding, only in the unfitness. apologize.
Just to follow up with, and did you?
Can I just follow up on that last? But then that last statement. So you're suggesting that because the legislature did not specify a burden of proof, and if we were to conclude it that there isn't one because of that, that somehow violates the Constitution because then the court doesn't have to have confidence in the termination decision? Because I think, again, having sat in that seat, it's a tough thing to do, even when the evidence and the arguments are overwhelming that this unfit parent just can't, for whatever reason, parent this child safely. I don't think any judge terminates without having confidence in that decision. And that's where this is kind of a, I don't want to call it a special proceeding because that has a special definition under the law, but it's different. And I think that's why the Wisconsin legislature and other legislatures around the country have focused on the best interest of the child. I do view that as a standard, and I think all the judges take that really seriously. And I don't think you meant to suggest otherwise, but you did make the statement that it suggests that the court doesn't have to have confidence in its decision. Could you elaborate on that? And then I'm done.
Yes, and I think I would turn again to Addington versus Texas from the U.S. Supreme Court, which talked about the fact that the discussion we're having here and the reality of how it's done are different, and that this part, deciding what burden of proof would apply in a case is, they said, quote, largely academic, and noted that, quote, adopting a standard of proof is more than an empty semantic exercise, though, it reflects the value society places on individual liberty. And so to the extent that my comments were construed as trial judges are not taking it seriously, I do not mean that at all. I understand that I'm there every day and I'm making the recommendation and feeling the same way about it, that there's a lot of gravity in the recommendation that I make to the court. And it is, right? It's a little bit academic on how we decide what happens here. But the kind of public policy side of it that the U.S. Supreme Court has said again and again is that it signals to people what that importance and what that confidence is supposed to look like. We see that in Addington versus Texas. We see it in Inri Winship, which I neglected to put the citation to that case on my outline, but it is in my brief. It's kind of the same quote that comes up again and again, this degree of confidence that society believes we should have in the ultimate conclusion.
Counsel, I wanted to just two different questions, one to follow up with one of Justice Bradley's questions. I thought I heard you say that if this is a hearing where evidence is taken and facts need to be found, there therefore logically must be a burden of some sort of burden by one of the parties. And I just say, is that always true in custody proceedings and distribution of assets and the dissolution of marriage? It feels to me like there probably are circumstances elsewhere in the law where there is no particular burden, but there is a fact-finding component or a hearing that where the court might need to find some facts.
I think that kind of dovetails into my statutory argument here. I would note that the legislature uses the phrase best interests in Chapter 48 over 200 times. It's used in a wide array of circumstances, from something as simple as who's allowed into a hearing to how a TPR is finalized at disposition. The child's best interest is the entire stated purpose of Chapter 48. It's used extensively in 767. I want to say it might even be part of the determination of audiovisual recordings of children. Some of those contexts have a burden of proof and some of them don't. And I think some of that turns on, is it an evidentiary hearing or is it not? The silence in the statute does not necessarily mean there's no burden of proof.
I don't disagree with that, but I just want to make sure I understood you correctly. I mean, sometimes that doesn't have a burden and there is a normal civil burden. That's true. So is that true here? That's part of the question we're here to answer, because is that always true? Is it not always true? That's part of the question here. But are you just here, because this, your argument is because this is an evidentiary hearing, that there must therefore be a burden by one of the parties. Is that a proposition you're forwarding to us?
Essentially, yes. Because it's an evidentiary hearing, that the evidence needs to be balanced on its credibility, on its quality, on its quantity, and that the burden of proof is what gets us there.
So another line of question in terms of the way we conceive of this. It seems to me that there's kind of two ways of thinking about this, and I have not practiced in this area, so I'm just reading and benefiting from the wisdom of my colleagues and others. But one is that this is a lot like a criminal case in one sense, right, where potentially after the grounds phase has been established, that the parent has lost their entitlement to continue to parent their child in the same way that somebody who's convicted of a crime has lost their entitlement to some measure of liberty or property consistent with the law. And then you proceed to the second phase where you have a judge who decides whether we're actually going to deprive you of your liberty for how long, whether we're going to deprive you of your property for how long, because we've already determined that you've committed a violation, and a violation for which we can deprive you of a right you would ordinarily have under the law. And the other, at least way of thinking, another way of thinking about it, as I hear maybe you and some others saying, is that the grounds phase is just sort of like a notch down in their interest, that the parent still has some measure of their rights or even the full spectrum of their rights still, and so there must be some sort of further burden. And I just want to maybe hear you reflect on that. Am I thinking of it incorrectly? How would you work through that?
So if I'm understanding your question, and I apologize, so maybe just a kind of general example of how these cases kind of proceed. Especially in Milwaukee County, we have a very, very full docket. And so the reality of how this looks is we may have a jury trial in March. And if the unfitness finding is made, if there are grounds, at that point, sometimes we proceed immediately to disposition, and sometimes the parties can't. And you might be talking 4 to 6 months down the road that we can get to disposition. Sometimes you don't finish the same day. So maybe we're talking a full year before we even get disposition completed. The parent has the right to visit. The parent is consenting to everything that they're supposed to consent to. They have the full gambit of their parental rights until the TPR order is entered. And so again, the unfitness finding is academic, really in nature. The parent is not losing anything in the day-to-day of their right to parent.
That's true of a criminal. I mean, wouldn't that be true in the case of somebody convicted of a crime? They may or may not actually suffer consequences until later, at some point when a sentencing actually occurs, depending on the nature of the crime and circumstances. I know it's not totally apples to apples, but I guess it does go to this core question of whether the grounds phase does much of anything, and it's some, or if it's just like a little bit of a tweak down in what the parents have. And I guess, you know, at least, again, what I'm hearing is, in one side is, no, they've really have lost the entitlement to that right, and now the judge just needs to determine what's best for the child. Or it's just sort of some notch down, and there's still some burden by the state to continue to bring it to the finish line in some way, whatever the state thinks is best.
So that brings up a good point, I think, with the statutory argument, too. State-involved TPRs aren't the only TPRs, and it's not the only thing that 48426 applies to, because we have private, too. We have cases where a step-parent is coming in seeking to terminate another parent's rights or a full-blown private adoption situation. And so the state's not always a party. The constitutional analysis assumes that. Inherently, the constitutional analysis is turning on the interest and protections for and against state intervention mm-hmm. into the family. So it's really a statutory analysis of this issue that gives us a universal rule that will apply to both public and private TPRs. And in that sense, I think I was kind of thinking of, like, does the state still have something to do between grounds and disposition? No, not necessarily, because in a private TPR, there's still going to be a gap. The unfitness finding tweaks. You know, you may recall, in prior cases, I actually came up here and said, these are two parts of one proceeding. It would be clear and convincing evidence. No, my position has evolved. The unfitness finding, that's what the unfitness finding does. It tweaks the parent's right. It takes them down a notch that they don't get clear and convincing evidence anymore. That's the reality of what the unfitness finding does. I wanted to turn to the question from Justice Ziegler, going a little deeper on the statutory differences where best interest is used. To be sure, there are contexts where best interest is used where a burden does not attach because it's not an evidentiary determination. For instance, a court must consider a child's best interest when deciding whether to remove a foster parent from a hearing. Under Wisconsin Statute 48.299, sub 1, sub A, G. That is not a determination that's evidentiary in nature. The child's best interest is being used as a guidepost in that statute. And that decision, while important, is nowhere near the gravity of deciding, is it in this child's best interest to terminate their parents' rights? To assess the burden through a statutory interpretation, the court would look at the policies and purposes of the statutory scheme. The court is allowed to read in a statute. The court has done it before in Marquez versus Mercedes-Benz in 2012, Wisconsin 57. And silence in the statute being read in as preponderance in civil cases has happened over the years in several different contexts.
Is it read in divorce proceedings?
I am not aware of a case with divorce proceedings specifically.
What about the best interest of the child standard that's in custody and placement determinations in family court actions? That was the first part of my question.
I don't have any cases that address 767 or the determination in 767 specifically. It has been done in CHIPS disposition and extension hearings. That's in SDS versus Rock County. That's from District 4 of the Court of Appeals from 1989. It has been done in a case, Matter of Sullivan, from this court in 1998, where the court was reviewing an evidentiary hearing, reviewing to amend a death certificate. It was simply an evidentiary hearing, not a trial. The statute did not set forth a special burden. So absent that, the court concluded that it was preponderance.
Counsel, in following up that question, in the context of let's say a motion to modify custody. Who has the 767? Who has the burden in a motion to modify custody? If you know.
I do not know.
Advanced. The general premise is that a moving party, a petitioner, under our common law and our rules of evidence, the petitioner has the burden. Is that true in 767 in a motion for change of custody, if you know?
Your Honor, I see that I am out of time. May I briefly?
You may answer the question.
I do not know in the course of 767, but I am averring in this case that the moving party should have the burden of proof.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning again. My name is Elizabeth Miller, and I'm a deputy district attorney from Milwaukee County. Today, we are asking this court to decline to impose a burden of proof, a TPR disposition, for three reasons. First, the statutory scheme consistent with disposition evinces a clear intent by the legislature to not impose a burden of proof, so circuit courts can receive as much information as possible on the issue of disposition. Second, 48.426 provides trial courts with clear guidance as to how to assess what's in the child's best interest and also provides a standard. And third, Wisconsin's termination of parental rights scheme is fundamentally fair. So I'll begin with my first point, the statute itself, 48.427. This statute begins by stating that any party may present evidence.
Attorney Miller, a concern that I have is that if this court would determine that there, in fact, is a burden. What happens to all of the termination of parental cases, parental rights cases that have been completed? Would you be anticipating a flood of litigation? Would you anticipate parties asking that adoptions be undone? What do you think?
I would anticipate a flood of litigation, Justice Protasiewicz. In fact, we have several appeals on hold right now awaiting this court's very important decision on this issue. It has really put termination of parental rights and adoptions in flux in the state for the time being. And if we look at the plain language...
Also, if you're finished with that question, isn't it what happens with regard to the dispositional phase? Implicitly, there is some burden. The trial judge has to decide what's more persuasive. If I were going to use the definition of Wisconsin Jury Instruction 200 for burden, you know, the greater weight, and isn't that what the court did here? Weighed the different factors and found, I think, 3, 4, and 6 to have greater weight or more importance. Isn't it implicitly a function of the court, in your interpretation, differing from others, that what prevails has to be more persuasive? It's implicit in the proceedings.
So, Justice Bradley, what I would say is the statute makes it very clear that there isn't a burden. That was an intentional decision by the legislature.
What words in the statute do you find that says there is no burden?
Several, in fact. We can start with...
Those words don't appear.
Those specific words do not appear in the statute.
Well, answer my question.
Those specific words, however, Justice Bradley, also do not appear in 48.31, which imposes the burden of proof of clear and convincing evidence for grounds. In fact, what it says is must be established by clear and convincing evidence. So when we look to 48.427, there's no similar language in 48.427. In fact, it says the parties may make recommendations. So had the legislature intended to impose a burden, it would have used language similar to 48.31.
Who has the burden of production?
Under 48.427, Your Honor, no one has the burden of production.
So it's kind of a free-for-all. I know Milwaukee may be different in the way they proceed, but I heard both of counsel that appeared before you indicate that it is the state, in a case where the state is the moving party, that starts out. Both counsels said that. Now, do you agree with that? That because I don't know the procedures in Milwaukee, or does a judge say, who wants to go first?
Well, historically, before this issue came up, the state would proceed, but what's been happening more recently is the parties actually get together and they will schedule the witnesses based on availability. So that's what's been happening since this issue has arisen. So we've been able to work that out.
In the rest of the state, in the past, I can't tell you today, but I can't think of a hearing that I participated in or those in the counties surrounding me at disposition would say, who wants to go first? I mean, it is the moving party, the petitioner here, that would go first. So you're saying there is no burden of production. Ollie, Ollie Olson, all in free if you start first.
Well, if you look at the entire statutory scheme, it's pretty clear that the legislature intended to receive as much information as possible. Because, again, the statute is permissive as to whether anyone presents evidence, but the court still required in public TPRs to consider the court report. The foster parents have the right to make a statement. Even under Brandon S.S., the foster parents who aren't parties have the right to present information to the court.
Is there a burden of production at sentencing?
Honestly, Your Honor, I cannot answer that question. I have not practiced criminal law in over 20 years.
How does this idea that you receive as much information as possible, and even the idea that you're supposed to do something in the best interest of the child, how does that negate having a burden of proof? I mean, what we're talking about here is when you're the judge and you go back and you look at all of these things and the chart and you look at what you filled in, implicitly, as Justice Bradley said, you must be holding it to some kind of standard. How are you not holding it to a standard?
I'm so glad you asked this question. There are actually sort of two parts to your question. The first is, if we look at this as an evidentiary hearing in which there's a burden of proof, right? So I'm a moving party. I put on my evidence. What happens if at the close of my evidence I haven't met my burden? I lose. My motion's dismissed. Similarly, if this is considered to be a court trial, as the guardian ad litem argued in her brief, then that means the rules of civil procedure related to court trials apply, which includes 805.17 subsection 1 related to directed verdicts, which means if at the close of my case I haven't presented enough evidence, I lose. That can't be what the legislature intended for TPR cases, because if I go first, I go before the guardian ad litem, which means the court is going to make its decision before hearing from the rest of the parties.
Okay.
And oftentimes, Your Honor, oftentimes it is the other parties who have the most compelling information that's going to help the court make its decision.
Yes. And I have some experience in TPR cases, though it has been a long time. I'm not saying the court doesn't have to hear everything. The statute makes very clear that the court has to what they have to hear. The difference is, at the end of the day, doesn't the judge implicitly looking at the evidence and figuring out whether to terminate or not to terminate, which, by the way, is still the same issue that this case started with that the state brought, weighing it. It has to be weighing it. And whether it is in the best interest of the child, fine, but there has to be a level by which you're implicitly holding it to. And why wouldn't we want to say what that level is so that it's clear, so that it's the same as any other civil case where you have that happening, and so that everyone understands, because otherwise aren't we risking that one judge is saying, oh, no, I have to hear so much more, and another judge in their mind is saying, no, I really don't need that much to get to that termination finding. I mean, either way, it's happening.
So I have 2 points I want to make sure I get to both in addressing your question. First, 48.426 lays out the standard, best interest of the child. Best means best. It's not what's okay, what's tolerable. Second,
what level, though?
The factors. Well, I would.
How do you know if it's best?
We know because we look at the factors under 48.426 subsection 3. They provide courts with clear guidance, and courts have been using these factors for decades and carefully considering what's in a child's best interest. And we've seen these from multiple, you've seen them from cases that have been reviewed. But to the first part of your question, there's a difference between a burden of proof and a standard of proof. And it's the state's position that the state doesn't bear the burden of proof because the court has to receive information from all parties. Because remember, the court's decision has to be calibrated to the child's best interest, regardless of whether that's a position or a decision to grant or dismiss the petition. Under Sheboygan County versus Julie A.B., this court stated that the decision to dismiss must also be calibrated to the child's best interest. And so imposing a burden of proof on any one party is inconsistent with the court receiving all of that necessary information and taking it into account. So I understand and respect your position about the standard of proof, and if this court chooses to impose a standard of proof, of course, that's your decision to do whatever you want on the merits of this case. We would have no issue with that. My concern is limiting the information the court receives by imposing a burden.
I don't think anyone's saying that the information would be limited. I don't see how we would override a statute that tells us exactly what you're supposed to look at.
Well, but if we're saying this is a court trial and the rules of civil procedure apply, then so does 805.17 sub 1. And if this court wants to put that rule in your decision, we would be okay with that, that the court still has to hear the information. Our concern is we don't want to cut off information because disposition.
Can I ask you a question?
Of course.
I shouldn't say it that way. Why would you think a judge would want?
Never mind.
I'm using judicial restraint here. Why would you think a judge would cut off testimony at a dispositional hearing, not giving one of the participants an opportunity to participate if there's a burden of proof? That doesn't follow for me.
So I don't know that a court would necessarily want to cut anything off, but if the law says I haven't met my burden by the close of my case, that's the law.
And that's the danger of this court imposing a burden where the legislature hasn't, isn't it? Because if you have to go first and the judge isn't satisfied or is questioning the best interests, then case dismissed and the guardian ad litem wouldn't have the opportunity if you don't meet your burden. Isn't that right, counsel?
That's exactly right, Justice Bradley. And in fact, we have often had cases, because unfortunately I've been doing this for a very long time, where it's not the state's presenting the most compelling evidence at best interest. I had a situation with a 15-year-old who came to the hearing and let the court know his position, and that was the most compelling information that the court could have received.
But that, that judge would be acting contrary to the words of the statute that indicate that those present, the participants, have an opportunity to offer evidence. They may, whatever the language is, I don't have it right in front of me, all of them may offer. So any judge who cuts off contrary to the words of the statute would be committing error, I would guess. Wouldn't you?
Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, I'm not a judge. I don't get to make those decisions as to whether someone's committing error.
If a judge doesn't give some opportunity to present any evidence or testimony at the dispositional hearing and declines the opportunity, you can read the statute. Isn't the judge acting in contravention of the statute then?
So the statute as it stands now, Justice Bradley, I agree, states that there is not a burden of proof, that parties are making recommendations to the court. So if the court were at this point...
That's nice, but let's focus on the words that I'm focusing on in the statute. You've already indicated the statute does not say there is no burden of proof, but the statute does say that each party has the opportunity to, let me get past the 14th Amendment and get to the statute, has the opportunity to present evidence, right, at the disposition.
Right. The specific language is any party may present evidence.
Yes, that's right. Thank you for your assistance with that. And so if a judge denies that opportunity, this is not a difficult question, I don't think. If the judge denies that opportunity, is the judge acting in contravention of the statute?
At this point, yes.
So a judge can't force someone to present their position under the language of the statute. Why would anyone who's going to win, if you have a burden of proof and you haven't really presented much, why would anyone present other evidence? It would be dismissed if we impose a standard.
That's correct.
Well, and even if, to Justice Bradley's point, okay, I'm the judge, I have to let everybody who wants to talk talk, so I'll let the guardian ad litem make her argument, but if she doesn't have a burden of proof, if the burden's on the state, it's kind of a hollow opportunity, isn't it?
Yes, and I think that this is actually reflected in the Court of Appeals decision when they imposed a shared burden. It reflected that conflict, that we want to hear this information, and we're not sure how to do that while imposing a burden of proof, because this isn't really just a petitioner versus respondent situation. Every TPR case at the outset has four parties. By the time we get to when things are contested, maybe one parent has defaulted, but we have three parties, and it's how do you allocate a burden on any one party when the idea is for the court to receive all of this information.
It seems to me, actually, that once the state has established unfitness and grounds to terminate, and then we get to the dispositional phase where the best interest determination and the best interest of the child, not the parent, is paramount, it seems to me that it would fall to the guardian ad litem, who represents the best interest, to present the evidence one way or the other. So it seems to me the guardian ad litem would start. But this is where we get into judges making the law instead of doing what the legislature directed us, I think. Do you agree or disagree?
I agree that is the problem with imposing a burden of proof on one party in a TPR case. And I will concede that in the vast majority of cases, of course we're able to meet this burden. That's not the issue. We have those cases where, like I said, the teenager, we've had situations where perhaps the non-contesting parent comes in and they testify and they give the most compelling information. We can't impose a burden of proof on one of the parents.
You make this sound like there's no way to make this happen, but are you aware that I think the count that I had at this point was like 33 states do this? And there's only 3 states that we could find that don't impose a burden at the second phase, and that all of them talk about best interest of the child. So if this is such a crazy scheme, how do all these other courts figure this out?
I actually spent 4 days going down the rabbit hole of researching other states, so I could probably answer your question. Answer your question for any specific state. There are many states. Arizona, I know that was referenced by Attorney Sobeck, doesn't have factors associated with best interest. The issue is just determine what's in the child's best interest. So because Wisconsin has those factors and those specific things that the courts are supposed to consider, that provides courts with the clear guidance. There are also actually several states, as you noted, that don't have a standard. I want to say Wyoming, Montana, Mississippi, North Dakota. They don't even have a best interest determination. Some states, there's such as Nevada, there's a presumption that if the child's been out of home for 14 of the most recent 20 months, that termination's in the child's best interest.
So what I hear you saying is that because there's specific factors that the court's supposed to look at, that somehow negates what we would normally have in almost every other civil proceeding that involves evidence, which is clear and convincing, but because there's these factors that the court is supposed to look at, that somehow negates the need for a burden.
It's not just the factors, it's also the language in 48.427. Those combined indicate that the legislature didn't intend to impose a burden of proof.
So Attorney Miller, the guardian ad litem in a termination of parental rights case has what I would assume is a attorney-client privilege file of information, correct?
They do, yes.
And I'm assuming you don't have access to that file, is that correct?
We don't have access to that file. And in the situation, the example I gave earlier, I would not have called that child because I wouldn't have spoken with that child and had information as to what they wanted to present to the court.
So if the burden laid solely on the state, you may not have all the information to present, correct?
In fact, yes. In fact, the state does have the vast majority of information as it relates to grounds, but not once we get to disposition. It is the family members, the parents, who have the best information related to the third factor, the relationship between the child and the other family members, and also even the second factor about the age and health of the child at the time of removal. It's those family members who can present information as to how things were before the state got involved. And I just wanted to, before I forget, address something that the guardian ad litem brought up about not all termination of parental rights cases involving state action. As the petitioner, HC had the burden of establishing that this statute was facially unconstitutional, which means under State v. Wood that it's unconstitutional in any circumstance. And I apologize that the parties hadn't thought to brief this, but I do want the court to be aware that there are circumstances in which 48.426 and 48.427, even if the court disagrees with me here, are constitutional, and that's in those private TPR cases, because there isn't a state action in those private TPR cases. So HC's facial challenge must fail because of that, but we would still ask this court to consider the due process argument as it relates to state-initiated cases, because this is a very real issue right now for practitioners across the state, and it does need to be resolved.
Does a parent have a due process right at a dispositional hearing?
Yes. Yes, parents do have due process rights at disposition. As we know, due process is flexible. It's not rigid. At its core, it requires the opportunity to be heard at a meaningful time and in a meaningful manner. And when we get to disposition, parents have the right to be heard at a meaningful time and in a meaningful manner. And by the time It's important that we're considering the due process analysis. We look at the entire statutory scheme and the entire process. Because by the time we get to disposition, the parents had the right to notice, they have the right to an attorney, they have the right to the state providing that attorney if they're indigent, they have the right in Wisconsin to a jury trial at grounds. Wisconsin is one of only 5 states that allows a jury trial at the grounds phase of the proceedings. And they have the right at that trial to make the state prove its case by clear and convincing evidence, and it's only then that they're found unfit. And that unfitness finding, that's an individualized determination of unfitness, which we know the Constitution requires. And that is the state versus respondent. That's the case. But when we get to best interest, the analysis changes, and it has to change, because we're no longer trying to assess wrongdoing. We're no longer saying the parent has done something wrong. We're not seeking to punish the parent. We're looking at what's best for the child. And in that, as I've stated numerous times, you're probably sick of me saying it, the court has to consider all information on that issue. And imposing a burden on one party runs the very real risk of the court not receiving all of that information. These are heart-wrenching decisions. We want the courts to consider the factors carefully, to analyze them on the record, to know why they made the decision that they did. Courts have been doing this. It's been working. We'd ask this court to clarify that Wisconsin law does not impose a burden of proof at disposition, and our current statutory scheme is fundamentally fair.
Counsel, why are you, you've been doing this for a long time. The statute's been around for quite a long time at this point.
Yes.
From your view as a practitioner, what has this looked like on the ground, and why is this case coming to us decades and decades after this statute was enacted?
I can't answer the latter part of your question, Justice Hagedorn, but on the ground, practitioners, parents, they walk into court knowing exactly what the court is looking for. Those factors are clear and unambiguous. This court stated so in Sheboygan County versus Julie A.B. They provide courts and practitioners with guidance. These aren't decisions being made on whims. They aren't decisions that can't be measured and evaluated. They're thoughtful, careful considerations. Thank you.
Thank you.
One of the topics that was addressed in some detail during the state's argument was this idea that if we have a burden of proof, the evidence that might be presented by other parties, and more specifically the guardian ad litem, would sort of go out the window. And I wanted to address that a little bit, and because that's not how I envision it, and I don't think that's how it would work if there is a burden of proof in these cases at disposition. Ultimately, at a disposition hearing, you know, the state is trying to present evidence to support termination of the child's, of the parent's right to their child, what's in the best interest of the child. I think this court can consider, in making that determination as part of the evidence that's presented, the arguments or evidence that's presented by the guardian ad litem as well, because the guardian ad litem at a disposition hearing picks a side. You know, they make a determination that I'm either going to argue that termination's in the best interest of the child, or I'm going to argue that it's not. And so even if there's a burden of proof, their evidence can still be considered as part of that burden of proof. Ultimately, it's on the state to make sure enough evidence gets put into place at that hearing to terminate. But there's no reason the court would have to just disregard the guardian ad litem's evidence or make a decision before the guardian ad litem presents his or her case, assuming it aligns with the state. I guess I also just wanted to talk a little bit about You know, in general, why I don't think that a discretionary decision works in these types of cases. The first is that it doesn't, or it fails to recognize the importance of the decision that a court is making at disposition. The court at that point is determining whether or not it's going to deprive a parent permanently of a constitutional right to parent their child. And because of that, we have to give some guidance to the court as to how to make that decision. We have to instruct the court on how much evidence and quality of evidence the court has to hear in order to reach that monumental decision that it has to reach at disposition in these types of cases. Otherwise, if it is just a discretionary decision, I mean, in some way, we're sort of just allowing the court to make a gut call based on the factors within the statute without providing the court guidance as to how much evidence it has to hear and the quality of evidence it has to hear in order to terminate a parent's rights.
I think it's more than a gut call. Go ahead, Justice Brett.
By your definition of apparent definition of discretionary decision. I mean, we have many cases that indicate the exercise of discretion, of course, will be upheld by a certain proceeding, by an appellate judge, as long as the judge follows the law and doesn't misstate the facts. In other words, just misstates the facts or law. So those are guidelines that a judge has in exercising discretion. It's not like flipping a coin. You've got to follow the law. And this case is about whether, in large part, whether or not the law provides a burden of proof in this action. So discretionary doesn't mean willy-nilly.
No, I agree it doesn't. And maybe the best example I can think of is like really close cases. If you have a really close case, you know, as to whether it's in the best interest of the child for their rights to be terminated, I think you then are, if it's a discretionary decision, you are sort of left in a position where the judge is then ultimately just making a gut decision. And we're not requiring the state or the petitioner to reach any burden of proof before we take away this really important substantial rights.
That sounds like a policy argument, and I understand that part of that is in some sense of fairness, but couldn't the legislature make a different determination about how this should look?
My red light is on.
Go ahead and answer.
Saved by the light.
I don't think so. I mean, and that's due to due process considerations. Because the right that the parent has the potential to lose is so important, I don't think the legislature can just say with.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Interesting oral argument. The court is adjourned. We will meet in closed conference at 1:30, but in the meantime, just Bradley will be out here to talk with the school group that's here today, and thanks for visiting with us.
All right, we're adjourned.